People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. As more and more people have come to experience homelessness in Canada, encampments have sprung up in cities across the country. Without a system to find adequate housing for people in a timely manner, people are pushed into public spaces where a patchwork of bylaws often dictates where and when people are allowed to exist. Law professor Alexandra Flynn argues that bylaws constitute the primary response of the state to unhoused people living and surviving in public space. In The Bylaw State, Flynn and co-author Joe Hermer frame bylaws as central to the story of homelessness and urban governance. They cover how, in the absence of legislation outlining how municipalities must treat people living in encampments, court decisions have set out minimum protections for unhoused people. The book also looks at two case studies touching on Moccasin Flats in Prince George and Crab Park in Vancouver. I spoke with Alexandra Flynn.
My name is Alex, and I'm a professor at UBC. I teach and research the law, and mainly around issues of housing and homelessness.
And you are one of the authors of The Bylaw State. And I'm wondering if you could tell me, how have municipal governments, as you present in the book, come to be on the front lines of sort of regulating homelessness?
Yeah. So in Canada, we don't have a very good housing framework, like a legal framework for who's responsible for housing. So most other issues, there's a government that's listed in the Constitution, and that's the government that you would turn to be accountable. And so housing is one of those areas where nobody really wants to be accountable, because it costs money and it's complicated, and different powers land at different governments. And so because of that, you know, after about three decades of not enough funding in building new housing, and especially housing that's deeply affordable, we've gotten ourselves into a situation where we're short at least 4.5 million homes. And we just don't have enough homes. We don't have enough homes for people who need them. And so the people who end up getting priced out, you know, have to move into rental housing. We don't have enough of that. And then if there's anything that happens, you know, a mental health crisis or a divorce or you lose a job or all sorts of things that just, you know, that just can happen to anyone, you know, people can find themselves into becoming without a home, without a secure home. And eventually, if they really don't have any way to fall back on support, they may become so poor that they need to sleep outside. And then it becomes a municipal issue because municipalities oversee public space. And so, you know, parks are not meant to be slept in. And there's bylaws that are written that say that, you know, you can't be here overnight, or you can't pitch a tent. You can't use this space in a certain way. And those are the bylaws that end up being used to remove people from those public spaces.
And so what were the questions about this process, these bylaws, that you set out to answer in your book?
Yeah. So my colleague and friend Joe and I, you know, we'd been part of a project for the Federal Housing Advocate where we were basically giving a sense of what was the situation with homelessness and with encampments around the time of the pandemic. And in the process of doing that, we couldn't really find anything about the legal aspect of bylaws and what it meant for unhoused people. And so we felt like that was really missing, and it was something that was needed out there. Like, why are, exactly your question, actually, like, why are bylaws, why are we talking about bylaws when we're talking about homelessness? And so we sat down to tell the story of bylaws and how they've come to be the way in which homelessness is governed in Canada.
Well, could you give me some examples of the things municipalities are aiming to accomplish through bylaws that sort of regulate or otherwise interact with homelessness?
Yeah, so there's a bit of a range. I mean, Joe actually did this big research project and found that most bylaws were pretty much crafted in the same way, same kind of language. So there's a huge chunk of bylaws that govern streets or parks that are pretty uniform across Canada, and those just aim to regulate those spaces. So the premise of them is that everybody uses these spaces and we need to find a way to live together. So like, what are the rules that need to be followed in these spaces in terms of, loitering and garbage and how long you can stay and what you can put there. More recently, after some legal cases that went to the court about the use of bylaws and the application to homeless people, some municipalities have created specific bylaws around homelessness where they say, there's no sleeping outdoors allowed except, and then they kind of provide for the language that the court decisions do, which is unless it's at night and there's no shelter space available. But then these bylaws go on further to say, but not near schools or playgrounds or flower beds or et cetera, like a whole list, or, and not this park and not that park. So they basically are taking the language of the court case and then they're adding to it other restrictions around where tents and homeless people can go.
And as you outline there, and you outline in the book, there seems to be this dance between municipalities and bylaws, and then the court system. And I'm wondering if you could tell me how the courts come into this picture in the first place.
Yeah, so the courts end up being this really important player in this whole situation because the municipalities will, basically look for an injunction to remove people from encampments. And so they go to court and they argue why this is necessary. Sometimes they don't even go to court, but if they do, they argue why it's necessary. And increasingly, homeless people with their lawyers and advocates will argue that the use of that injunction or the attempt that the city's trying to do is against the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It violates the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and specifically Section 7, the right to life, liberty, and security of the person. And so that's the situation that we've come to, which is a municipality will take some kind of action. And if people can, and it's very difficult to find lawyers who work in this area or who have the capacity to bring these cases, but if they can, they'll go to court and fight against it and say, you can't do that. You can't remove this encampment because there's no shelter spaces for us to go to. And it's therefore violating our life, liberty, and security of the person.
And you've touched on a few cases where there seems to be this pattern that emerges where a municipality is looking to have an encampment removed or cleared out, and a judge essentially comes down and says, well, if you want to be able to do this, you need to show that there are places for the people living in that encampment to go. And there's some nuance from decision to decision about what exactly that looks like, whether that's available shelter beds, whether that's shelter beds that kind of would match up well with the people who are actually living in the encampment. I'm wondering if you could talk to me about what we see the results of some of these processes being.
Yeah, so the court, so in 20, 2009, there was a landmark decision from Victoria called Victoria and Adams, and that's the case that set this framework of municipalities cannot remove people at night if there's not enough accessible shelter space. So since then, there's been a number of other cases that have been brought in British Columbia and Ontario. I should note that because of the legal system, a case that's decided in BC will be binding on other courts in if it concerns BC municipality, but it doesn't apply in another part of Canada. So each province has its own set of decisions related to this issue. But increasingly, these cases are coming and asking, like, what does accessible mean? What is the meaning of this? Because the main challenge with shelters to begin with temporary shelters, is they're not a very good space for most unhoused people to go to. They're congregate, meaning like people sleep usually in big rooms together. They might have their belongings stolen. They might have other reasons why that's not an appropriate space for them. Maybe they have a partner, maybe they have a pet, maybe they have trauma of being in that kind of situation before and they can't sleep knowing that there's other people around them because they harmed in that situation, or a whole host of other reasons why a big open space like that is not appropriate for them. And so courts have increasingly said, what does accessible mean? And it doesn't, it means that it has to be appropriate for the people who are in that situation, who are in that encampment.
So how do some of these conditions or other factors of the court decisions, how do they play back into the municipal context? How do they kind of get translated from this is a decision to this is what a municipality does differently, or this is what all municipalities in, say, the province do differently?
So this is part of the reason why Joe and I make this argument that this is really the wrong way of regulating or even dealing with a humanitarian crisis like homelessness. Because if a case is brought, it's specific to the facts of that case, the people who are involved, the officials who are involved. So it's not like the courts are saying governments, municipal governments have to do X and Y. You know, that's not what's happening with the courts. They're deciding the facts of that particular case. So it means that we don't have very clear and specific rules for all municipalities about what they are supposed to do to address homelessness. Recently, there was a case that came out of Ontario, the Waterloo decision, which I'm happy to talk to. It's a huge game changer legal decision. And the court there did two really important things. So one thing that they did is, in addition to Section 7 of the Charter, they held that the bylaws in that case were discriminatory under the equality provision of the Charter, which really means that a so-called neutral bylaw that seems to apply to everybody equally actually isn't applying equally when it comes to people who are homeless. So homelessness was considered a ground, an analogous ground, because so many people who are homeless are racialized or Indigenous or have mental health issues or other challenges, or are women. You know, there's a whole host of disproportionate impact on certain people. So that's a huge game changer. But to answer your question, the second big game changer of that decision is that the court said, municipality, you need to come back here after you make changes to your policies. And we'll tell you if you can then remove these folks from the encampment. So the court it's called a Declaration Plus. And the court was essentially supervising the actions of the municipality. And it's really important because the court in that decision said some really noteworthy things, but one of them was, we don't want to be doing this. We, the courts, don't want to be doing this. We're doing this because governments are not acting. They're not addressing this issue of homelessness, which has increased by over 300% in the last 8 years. And so the courts are increasingly called to take on this role, but it's actually not their role to take on. It's the government's role to take on. And, but they don't trust, interpretation is they believe they need to keep jurisdiction over this issue to supervise what it is that the municipality does.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Alex Flynn. She's an associate professor at the Peter Allard School of Law at UBC and director of the Housing Research Collaborative. Flynn is also the co-author of The Bylaw State, a book which explores the intersection between Canadian municipalities and homeless encampments. What you seem to be suggesting that there's this vacuum around the rules that kind of regulate homelessness or various consequences of homelessness, and that municipalities are creating these bylaws to try and fill that vacuum, and then the court has a role in determining whether or not these bylaws infringe on people's charter rights in certain cases. What kind of tools do you suggest should be used to maybe fill this vacuum instead of what we have now?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, municipalities, quite frankly, don't have the resources to fix the crisis that we're in. Homelessness is part of a larger, as we talked about at the beginning, it's part of a larger issue with our housing situation, the gaps that we have in housing. And municipalities, you know, mostly rely on property taxes to fund their operations. They don't have a lot of money. This crisis is connected to income. It's connected to mental health services. It's connected to a whole host of health issues as well. And so it's landing on the front lines of municipalities. And I think municipalities are different, right? I used to work in a municipality. I mean, there's lots of people who are there and really want to help and really want to do the right thing, but there's just limits in the tools that are available for them. So the truth is, we cannot fix this issue by just relying on municipalities. The federal government and municipal governments have to be involved, and provincial governments have to be involved in figuring out a solution that addresses it. And it is possible, you know, like if you look to other countries and what they have done, they have implemented models of governance that draw on all governments to step in and provide the kind of help that they can. So what's my perfect alternative view? It's to recognize that this is a terrible crisis, that the legal framework that we have right now doesn't seem designed to fix it, but increasingly courts are going to say, this is the government's job to do it, and we're going to force them to.
And an inference I took from reading the book, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong or clarify this, was that basically right now, the way this plays out is that if you're going through homelessness, a lot of these bylaws basically make your life harder almost no matter what, no matter if you're doing things that are in some way, shape, or form harmful to other members of the public, that like in theory, these bylaws are trying to protect. They sort of make your life harder because you're experiencing homelessness. If that's the case, what do you feel like is a better kind of interim solution? Like, what are some of the specific issues with these bylaws, and what do you think could be done differently by municipalities who are presumably making these bylaws looking to address certain specific issues?
Yeah, so we actually have examples of municipalities that have adopted a housing rights framework, or like housing as a human rights framework, and recognize that people who are homeless need things like bathrooms. They need access to water. They need access to showers. They need safe places to keep their belongings. That the more stable they can be with those kinds of services, the more able they're going to be to transition into other forms of housing, as well as not being more harmed by being forced to move around all the time and trying to find some place that's safe for them to be. So, you know, in the absence of a multi-governmental, intergovernmental strategy to address this, municipalities could adopt this framework of drawing from human rights work. And there's, you know, the Federal Housing Advocate, The Shift, these organizations have put together lots and lots and lots of materials that are available to help. So that's one thing that can be done, is just adopting a human rights approach to homelessness. When I do a lot of work directly with advocates and with people who are living in this situation, and it's going to sound kind of like a small thing that could be done differently, but it's actually a pretty big thing, which is to treat people like they're human beings. And in the Waterloo case, we saw the judge say that as well. He said something like, you know, homeless people are not the other, they are us. And so the biggest thing that I heard from unhoused people myself was, treat us like human beings. And I think doing that changes everything. Like, bylaws are meant to regulate spaces. They regulate things like, what is garbage? You know, a blight that shouldn't be there in public space. And homeless people are treated in the same category. You know, like in one of the chapters in our book, we note that in one municipality, there's a form that can be filled out where members of the public can note if there's disorder, you know, like, is there trash? Is there this? Is there a homeless person? You know, like, those are not the same things. One of those people is a human being, and treating people in that way actually would make a profound difference in how interactions went and how discretion was used. you know, a lot of the choices that municipalities make are around discretion, what they consider to be loitering and what they don't. So I would say human rights, treating people like they're human beings. And then the third major thing is municipalities acting like advocates for all members of their community, including people who are unhoused. So, you know, there is a lot of power that comes from municipal organizing and lobbying towards other governments, provincial and federal. And so coming together and demanding that these other governments step up with resources to address this issue would go a long way as well.
And in your book, you look especially at two case studies in Prince George and in Vancouver. What do you think are the big takeaways from those stories?
So the big takeaways are that in both of these situations, there were multiple court cases that ended up taking place. And just this kind of dance that occurred between those living in the encampment and the municipality about what was appropriate for what had to be done in order for the unhoused people to be removed from this space. And so our takeaway from this is that it doesn't solve homelessness to do this, to have this dance where a court case will be brought, you know, there might be some delay in removing homeless people, but in the end, there's not a lot done to actually address the systemic issues that are at play. And so it's part of our larger thesis that this isn't helpful, you know, to use the court's time, to use the municipality's time, and definitely not the people who are living in the situation's time of, you know, sort of trying to remove people from these spaces without trying to figure out where they're supposed to go and how they're supposed to live dignified lives.
I'm remembering interviews that I have done in the past with folks from municipalities, and when presented with the fact that, you know, perhaps this isn't going to address the root causes, the response has been a sort of like, we know, but what we're trying to do is address the concerns of other people in the community or address these risks we feel the situation presents to the community. What do you feel is important about maybe, or what do you feel is the kind of context around that view of things?
Listen, I understand, you know, I live in a city myself. I know how complicated it is to, you know, want to have spaces where you can walk your dog and take your kid out and feel safe at night. And, you know, the issues that come about when there's people who are living in situations that, you know, like nobody really wants to be sleeping in a park. Especially if there's no services, no bathrooms, no showers, no water, you can imagine how difficult it is to survive but also to what the impacts are on that space. So I get it. And at the same time, these are our governments. They need to represent everybody that lives in the city, not just the people who have loud voices who are objecting. They need to come up with creative solutions to figure out how to make this work based on a human rights approach. And I know it's hard. I know it's difficult. But what we will have if that doesn't happen is more and more courts, as they have already done, making decisions that say, these are not the same. You know, an unhoused person doesn't have the same constitutional rights that a neighbor does. An unhoused person has protected constitutional rights. So their rights in this situation are higher than the soccer player or than the dog walker or than the kid who wants to use the playground, because they are so disproportionately impacted by the situation. And I guess I would say we have to confront the fact in Canada that we have created this situation of a housing and homelessness humanitarian crisis. We have done this through our governments, through our decisions around how much we tax, what our priorities are, and we have to make different decisions around it. So I don't think just because I think there are things that can be done, and we've seen things that have been done in other jurisdictions. Like for example, the City of London, Ontario, which created a whole framework, a human rights framework for homelessness in that jurisdiction by providing basic services and what that allowed for. You know, we've seen examples from Toronto on for hospitals that have used really creative solutions on how to bring services to people and create housing right on hospital grounds. We can make different choices as a society, and we have to do that. We should not be relying on these bylaws to be the way that we govern this crisis.
Do you think that this issue highlights something larger about just the governance structure in Canada and perhaps the disproportionate responsibilities thrust on municipalities compared with their ability to have any kind of revenue or real means of dealing with them? And even just like the amount of time available to the people working in the level of government to dedicate to solutions versus how many issues they're tasked with facing?
100%. Municipalities are considered creatures of the province under Canadian law. They cannot have income taxes. They don't have access to revenue to deal with the issues that fall on their doors. They're subject to the decisions of provincial governments. Even when they get funding for things like homelessness, there's a whole bunch of hoops that they have to jump through. If they get funding for capital expenses related to building housing, that doesn't address the operating costs, providing healthcare services and other services on site. It is an untenable situation that municipalities are on the front lines for this crisis and they don't have the resources available to fix it. And the reaction to that should not be that human rights get left behind, which is really the argument that Joe and I are making in our book.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on these issues?
Yes. So the federal government enacted a law called the National Housing Strategy Act in 2019. And as part of that law, they are mandated to have a national housing strategy. They've had one since the legislation was created. 2.0 is being discussed and decided now. So this should be one of the things that is on the list of items that the federal government takes seriously. This should be part of our national housing strategy to address homelessness. So for those of you who are listening, you know, if you have an opportunity to weigh in, the federal government will be consulting on the national housing strategy. Make your voices heard. Say that this is something that you care about as well. You know, voices really do make a difference.
Alex Flynn, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me on this.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Alexandra Flynn is an associate professor at the Peter Allard School of Law at UBC and director of the Housing Research Collaborative. She's also co-author of the book, The Bylaw State, Encampment Evictions, and the Struggle for Public Space.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY in Nanaimo, on CFMH in St. John, on CFUV in Victoria, on Dig FM in the Comox Valley, and now on CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio.
As our phones seemingly take up more and more of our attention, some apps promise to help us focus on the tasks we want to achieve. A group out of UBC says distraction blockers are often aimed at neurodivergent people, but in some cases, they could be inadvertently reinforcing a neurotypical worldview. Kevin Chow and Marvel Hariadi are part of a team who took a look at how neurodivergent people actually use distraction blockers. They're calling for more inclusive digital tools that recognize focus isn't a faucet.
I'm Kevin. I'm a postdoc at New York University at the Department of Technology Management and Innovation. I just recently completed my PhD at UBC, where my research broadly explored how to design tools to support people in being more productive, but also healthier and happier about their work. So that's the connection to this work with kind of focus apps helping, but looking at focus apps in a much more holistic kind of sense.
Hi, I'm Marvel. I just finished my undergraduate degree at UBC.
in computer science and business, which I know is a little bit out there. But my work, even before this research, focused on neurodivergency advocacy and inclusion. And so when I co-authored this paper with Kevin, that was what the focus that I really wanted to bring into the world with our human-computer interaction research here.
And so we're going to be talking about focus apps and neurodivergence today. Maybe to start with, Kevin, could you give me a sense of what are these apps? What are they intended to do, and how do they work?
Yeah, absolutely. So focus apps broadly are just tools that are, as their name kind of implies, they're designed to help you focus and be productive. And they've really skyrocketed in popularity, especially as, things like social media becomes more popular, distractions all over on the internet. They're just trying to vie for your attention. And so people are trying to find these ways to reclaim some of their attention, reclaim some of their focus so that they can get things done. We specifically looked at distraction blockers, which are a specific type of focus app, and they work by blocking distractions. So they might block an app on your phone, like let's say Instagram, for a certain amount of time, or they might block a certain website that might be distracting if you're on your computer. So they're all throughout, different devices, and some of them are built into your web browser as well to directly block things like Facebook, YouTube, or whatnot. And the idea is that yes, they. The idea is that by blocking these distractions, they can help you focus. But we might debunk that myth a little bit later in our conversation. So.
So that's one piece of the puzzle. We're also going to be talking about neurodivergence today. Marvel, you mentioned some of your work more generally is about neurodivergency advocacy. For the purposes of our conversation today, how would you define that term, neurodivergence?
Neurodivergence, essentially means anything that is divergent, so going away from the quote unquote norm of what our worldly society expects us to behave and cognitively think. And neurodivergency as a term also is very contentious because it depends on where you are, per country. Neurodivergency is not always the same as disability. Oftentimes it is. So, for example, in Canada, ADHD is both a disability and a neurodivergency, just to name an example. And it covers a really wide range of umbrella of lots and lots and lots of conditions, from autism, ADHD, anxiety, BPD, OCD. Well, our focus here for our research was specifically on the trifecta of anxiety, ADHD, and autism, because these three conditions have a lot of symptom overlap, especially in terms of productivity, but also have a lot of co-occurrence. So, about, I think, 4 in 10 of autistic people who are diagnosed with autism also tend to also be diagnosed with anxiety. Same with ADHD. There's just a lot of overlap between these three conditions.
So, what were the questions that you set out to answer about these focus apps and neurodivergent people?
Well, not me. I might call it the Kevin here also. We sought to figure out how, specifically in neurodivergent post-secondary students within the education space, because this is such a big demographic for these type of apps, and how they really use these apps beyond the traditional expectation of you get the timer and then you block for a certain amount of time and then you work. Because what we often found, like even as a hypothesis, you could say in the beginning of this research, is that a lot of the times that's it, that sort of traditional structure seldom worked for this population, especially that trifecta of ADHD, autism, anxiety. And so you're wondering, like, but at the same time, there's such a big demographic for it. So how are they really using it then? Is it different? Is it perhaps exaggerated? Or are they really going against the use case to find a way that really works for them? Is it even in the realm of productivity that it really helps them?
So, Kevin, what did you end up finding about how neurodivergent people interact with these focus apps?
Well, I'll add on a little bit to Marvel's point earlier, which was an excellent answer. But one of the things that actually motivated some of our research questions, and then I'll touch on what we found, was that. Was just the fact that we, when you hop on the App Store and you just search up distraction blocker focus apps, you see a ton of these apps that are marketed towards people who have ADHD or who are neurodivergent in a sense. But we noticed that there wasn't a lot of literature that actually looked at this more specifically, and so we wondered, what we didn't see anyone actually talking to neurodivergent students about how they actually use these apps, and so that was kind of our intention with our research here. And what we found was really interesting. I think one of the two of the key findings I think that we found was one that people use these apps to help them do more than just manage their focus. And so for folks who are neurodivergent, part of what they need to learn to do is to kind of regulate their sensory environment, regulate their emotions. And that was what some folks who use these distraction blockers, they kind of co-opted them so that they were tools that also helped them regulate their emotions by blocking kind of sensory input from these distracting apps and websites and things like that. The other thing that we found was, which I think kind of speaks to the heart of the article and how we found that focus apps kind of are actually failing neurodivergent minds to a degree, is that these apps can actually cause them to feel a little bit of self-stigma. And so, you know, these apps seem to be built in a way that's very rigid and very that assumes that focus is kind of, there's only one right path to focus. When in reality, there are many different ways to focus. And I think we know that from experience, our own experience, but also just through research as well. And so these apps are built to assuming that focus is sort of like this faucet that you can just turn on and off. You know, as soon as I block, as soon as I trigger my distraction blocker to block distractions, I'm instantly in the state to focus. But what we found from talking to neurodivergent folks is that isn't necessarily true. A lot of them have developed a lot of rituals and techniques and methods in synergy with their distraction blocker to lead to a state of focus.
Well, I'm interested in this idea of we're being distracted by things on our devices. And so the solution is that we're going to have this like extra app on our devices that is going to help us through that. Could you talk to me about maybe just that as the framing? Like, what do you think is the important context around this idea of using the device to help you solve some problem that the device is hypothetically causing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this speaks to kind of something that we found in our findings as well, which is that some of our participants viewed these apps, like this additional app that you're going to install on your phone or whatever, that would help you manage your apps. Some of our participants viewed them as a crutch, you know, something that, will I have to depend on this all my life? Will I have to have this app all my life? Whereas others viewed it more as a scaffold. Hey, this is a temporary thing that I might turn on at some point of my life, you know, maybe when exam seasons are coming up, when something stressful is coming up, that I might just need a little bit more support. Or maybe right now I'm at a state where I need a little bit more support. And I think it really comes down to this idea of viewing our ability to focus as this sort of muscle. And I think for neurodivergent folks, this idea can be a little bit challenging because I think they've often been told by society or just based on the challenges that they face in day-to-day life that they're at this kind of starting, they might have more challenges with their focus, meaning that their starting point in terms of like their focus muscle might be different from someone else. But the idea is that it can be trained and developed, and in viewing these apps as more of this sort of scaffold that can help you get there or help you when you need it at certain times, that can lead to, I think, a healthier outlook on these apps overall and less of this sort of crutch-like framing of, do I need to have this app installed all my life?
So what are the maybe design pieces that your research has said could be changed or tweaked to make these maybe more useful for, I don't know if it's an oxymoron or a contradiction in terms to say like the average neurodivergent person?
Well, definitely the term average neurodivergent person is a definitely like hard thing to kind of get together because everyone is so different, you know, even with people who have the same conditions of autism or anxiety or a combination, whatever, people are so different. I would say if I had to boil it down, it's the idea of the right to self-determine, you know, the right to set up things, set up your apps, your environment, whatever it is, the way that works, especially for you, which does require a bit of trial and error. I do want to talk about one of my favorite findings from the study, which is this concept of digital simming. So that a lot of our neurodivergent participants, you know, they'd often used their distraction blocker, sit down, they block for, you know, whatever amount of time, but then oftentimes they would unblock it intentionally to let themselves scroll for a bit, let themselves sort of stimulate themselves with, you know, whatever media on their device, or if they're playing a game or, you know, whatever it is. And so in this way, they kind of intentionally turn off their blocker in order to give themselves space to stimulate. And I was actually looking at some research by Alora Young, who is also a neurodivergency PhD researcher in the States, talking about how this concept of seeking stimulation is a form of oftentimes seeking dopamine. And so, and this is also consistent with what participants said in our interviews, that they kind of need a little bit of a dopamine hit, just even to sort of get them remotivated back into wanting to do their work. Sometimes they would, maybe self-stimulate in the beginning, right before they even started to sit down and do their work. They kind of had a little moment to calm down by giving themselves a little moment to scroll, and then they set their blocker, or they do it between study breaks or whatever it is. And so I think a design pattern that we were looking at that I think we recommend if for people who do want to have this self simulation is this idea of we sort of give a certain amount of content in case, let's say it's Instagram Reels or TikToks, a set amount of time that fits perfectly into 5 minutes. And then this content could be curated to be really self-soothing, be calming. So a very specific set, nothing too addicting in whatever way that means for the user, and not too upsetting. So for example, maybe we might want to avoid like really upsetting news, like in this era of climate change, for example, just an example. And then so after exactly 5 minutes up and all the content fits neatly within that 5 minutes, then the blocker automatically can turn back on, and then we're back to business. And the idea behind this is that you kind of give a little bit moment to self-stim, but not too much that you get carried away into a rabbit hole and then you end up scrolling for 2 hours, which might have been me last night, but don't worry about that.
Well, there's also the dimension of this where we've been hearing increasingly in the last number of years about the design of some of the platforms you can access on your phone being changed to make it so that it's harder to stop using, being designed to keep you using it. Things like the endless scroll. We've all heard, no doubt, about the algorithm. Even just the framing of focus or like focus apps, I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, but there can be this framing that accompanies them of like, I am really struggling to focus. This is like a me issue in this environment of, well, all of these things are being designed to keep your focus and to keep you away from whatever it is that you maybe feel like you ought to be doing.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that more. Yeah, and because we have some really interesting research going on right now at UBC with Professor Dong Wookiun. Shout out Dong Wook, on like dark patterns. We were just at a conference in April in Barcelona, and there's some really interesting research in Maastricht University about these like addictive dark patterns and their compliance with EU law. EU apparently has some really great like legislation against dark patterns, and so this is just for the general populace. So there's not even research yet, as far as I know, that is also on neurodivergency. And I would love to look into that more. If any researchers are out there and want to talk more about this and research this, like hit me up. I would love to see more of this in the world.
When you say dark patterns, what do you mean there?
So dark patterns are these design patterns in tech that are, as they imply, they're dark. So then they intentionally get people to do unhealthy things, as quote unquote. And so the most popular one that I would say, in my opinion, is the most pressing right now is this whole thing about the infinite scroll. I don't know if you've ever seen, but the designer who made the infinite scroll has made a public statement that he regrets making it, right? Because a dark pattern that is intentionally made to keep you addicted on your device.
This is People First Radio. My guests are Kevin Chow and Marvel Hariati. They worked on a study out of UBC looking at how neurodivergent people use distraction blockers. So in the face of the infinite scroll, we maybe turn to the focus apps. And I know that these focus apps are sometimes like intentionally marketed at people who are neurodivergent. What do you feel, I don't know, is maybe like an inherent, is there maybe an inherent message about neurodivergence that's kind of conveyed through the design of these apps? Even though there's something that like we might turn to in the face of things like the infinite scroll.
Yeah, like I would say that this is a topic also in our research that we spoke in our paper is that there's kind of this implied lack, when you're neurodivergent, that you lack something and that you are therefore like less capable than other neurotypical people. That's the antithesis of neurodivergent, right? Neurotypical. That's I would say most people in the world. And so what we also discussed explicitly in the paper, like if anyone here wants to go out and read it, is that this idea that we can redesign these apps or redesign our whole systems, you know, in the world even, I would go as far to say, to sort of both uphold the strengths that a lot of neurodivergent people have, you know, with their conditions, and not just treat them as less than. You know, so for example, a lot of people with the trifecta of conditions often have more creative thinking and nonlinear workflows. So they're really good with multitasking and types of work that might require very multifaceted, you know, things like going on at the same time, you know, like juggling multiple hands at the same time, shall we say. And these sort of the way that our world works, the way our tech works, and the way our productivity culture works is that we are forced to sort of focus on being good at one or a few things at a time, and just really like be productive for a linear and rigid amounts of time throughout the day. And then a lot of times when neurodivergent people cannot hold themselves to that standard, they feel like, is there something wrong with me? Like, what's like, oh my God, am I just lazy? And so I want every neurodivergent people out there, who anyone who's listening to this, to know there's nothing wrong with you. The way your brain works is just different from the standard of the world, and that's perfectly okay. It's more of a matter of finding out how do we fit that brain into the rest of the world. Okay. But I've been talking for too long. I'm going to pass it to Kevin now.
Yeah, I can jump in a little bit. But really, really well put, Marble. I really want to emphasize that I think one of the main things that of this research is that if a focus app isn't working, it doesn't mean you are a problem. Joe, you mentioned how, you know, there's what the term is called, kind of the attention economy, right? The idea is that companies are vying for your attention now because that's where they can show you kind of more ads or kind of build on your engagement, user engagement, things like that. And those are the metrics that they're interested in. And that's the world that we're in now, right? Attention is a resource, and they want that resource from you. And so if you're really fighting an uphill battle, and I think neurodivergent folks with their specific brain wiring and specific challenges that they might have are facing especially even more uphill of a battle. But if these apps aren't working for you, our research shows that it's not you that's the problem. It's these apps that are designed assuming that the right way to focus is just this way where you follow this sort of Pomodoro timer-like technique. I'm sure folks may or may not have heard of it before, but it's this idea that you try to set aside 25 minutes or some amount of time to focus, put away your phone, everything, assuming that you can just focus in those 25-minute blocks, take a break, then another 25 minutes. And that's a very like structured way of working. And it doesn't really draw on the strengths of neurodivergent individuals, which is something that I think we want to design for as well. Design with a strengths-based framing, not from a deficit-based framing, not from this idea that, hey, how do we cover up your weaknesses or deficits, but rather how do we empower your strengths? And so Marvel touched on it a little bit, but folks like who have ADHD experience this phenomenon called hyperfocus, where they can really just sit down and work for hours on it. Like if you've ever had, I mean, I think all of us have had this experience of kind of going on this rabbit hole and just really, you know, hours fly by. And that can actually be super, a really productive time for people who have ADHD. But these apps assume that you need to work in these 25-minute blocks. And so you might work in 25 minutes and then time's up. And then suddenly for someone who has ADHD, they're out of their flow before they even got into it. And so the idea is that, yeah, I think the takeaway for us really is that if Focus app isn't working, it doesn't mean you are a problem. We need to design apps that support all sorts of diverse ways of working, not just assume that there's one right way.
From doing this research, do you feel like still there is a significant role for focus apps to play in helping people focus? Like, do you feel like that is a good starting point to address some of the issues that people might be having or tech might be causing for people?
Yeah, I think I view it as that these apps, they absolutely can help. They've helped me in the past. Sometimes I still use them as well. The point isn't that they're all bad. It's that they're just currently often designed for one way of focusing. And they kind of fail to consider the needs, unique strengths of neurodivergent individuals. And so I think my view is that one, we need to kind of approach the design of these focus apps with a more inclusive lens. And I think our research begins to do that. I think there are people who are also starting to look in this direction. And two, I think we need to treat these apps, we need to use these apps in a way where we don't assume that if it's not working, it's us that's the problem. I think we need to have this sort of openness to experimenting with what might help with our focus or not. A lot of these apps might be designed like this one app might work for you because the way that you focus is really aligned with how this app works. Or perhaps in just the specific season or context of your life, that app works. But maybe on a regular basis, it doesn't work, and it's okay to not use it. I think a lot of people feel a lot of shame, which is something that I think we found too from talking to the neurodivergent students in our study. When these apps don't work, or when even while I'm using these apps, I still can't focus, and a lot of that has the blame has been assigned to themselves. When I really think, I really would encourage folks to take this sort of open kind of experimental approach to using these apps, to figuring out how and what works best for your focus.
If there are people out there who have never tried using any kind of focus app or maybe weren't even really aware of them being out there, I'm wondering for both of you, either from your own personal experience or from doing this research, if there are people who find that they're having issues, maybe being distracted, or they like a day passes and they go, wow, I spend 3.5 hours doing unproductive things on my phone and I would like to change that. Are there any recommendations either of you would have for things people in that situation might want to check out?
So I can speak directly to what our participants have used in our that we studied, and also some I've discovered since the research has been published. So a forest was a really popular one. So forest is the one with you plant little trees every time you set a timer, and so there's an aspect here of gamification where it makes it fun to see your little forest grow because every time you successfully complete a focus like block for like I don't know an hour, 30 minutes, whatever you want to set it, you contribute to your little garden. Paid feature, I believe you can also contribute to like planting a tree. So if you're interested in that like go green aspect, which I think everybody should be interested in, that's also great. If you're an Android user, I'm a proud Android user. I don't care what anybody says. I use AppLock. And if you're an Apple user, there's already Apple Screen Time natively attached to your phone, which I know a lot of our participants used as well. One thing is that for me, I also have an iPad, is that I tend to just like press add 10 minutes, and that happens over and over again. And then in the end, I'm there sitting for 3 hours on YouTube shorts and feeling very bad about myself. So I would also recommend stuff like Cold Turkey. That is an actual name of an app, Cold Turkey.
I think Marvel gave a lot of really good specific suggestions. I was just thinking about how to answer this question because I think, like my answer to the previous question, I've just experimented with so many things over the years, and some things have worked, some things have sucked. Maybe I'll answer this from sort of a different angle, which is some kind of practices that I do, maybe not app specific. I am an iOS user, so we have breadth of perspective here. And I do use Apple Screen Time from now and then to kind of block certain apps and kind of when something's coming up, and let's say it's something that I know that I hate doing, and I will probably procrastinate on it. I will probably be distracted or want to distract myself from it. Then I might turn on a blocker specifically for that time, and kind of use it for that period of time. The other thing that I like to do is, and I think this is growing in popularity now, is to just try to actually make using your phone a little bit less rewarding or interesting by making the whole screen grayscale. You can do this on your iPhone as well. It's kind of built into it's part of the accessibility settings, and you can make your whole screen grayscale. It makes everything a little bit less interesting or rewarding. It's less interesting to use your phone, and so for certain periods of time, when everything's in grayscale, I'm just like, you know what? Let's go do something else instead, rather than look at this hard to navigate, ugly looking screen. And so that's something that I found has consistently worked for me. And there's ways to set it up so you can easily turn that toggle on and off.
Marvel, Kevin, is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation on this today?
If I could leave then all the neurodivergent people here, like, or how shall I say, like, if you suspect you're neurodivergent, please, if it's within your capability and budget, seek a diagnosis. It makes life so much easier to know exactly what you're working with. And secondly, there's nothing wrong with you. Your brain is working differently, and working in a magical way all on its own. I don't mean that in just like the kindergarten like teacher way. I also mean that in the sense that like there's so much magic to your brain as a neurodivergent person that you have not, most likely you have not tapped into just yet, and you just don't realize how absolutely amazing you are. Don't let anything, especially the productivity culture of this world, tell you otherwise.
And I think for me, maybe what I'll leave folks with is that we've been talking a lot about neurodivergent folks, but I really do think there's this idea in we're trying to create more inclusive design right here, right? We're trying to design these tools in a way that is more inclusive of all people, including neurodivergent people. And even though we've been talking about neurodivergent folks today, I really do think that more inclusive designs in Focus S will help all people. There's this idea in inclusive design called the curb cut effect. And so if you've ever seen a curb and you've seen it kind of slope into the road now, that was originally designed to be inclusive to for people who are wheelchair users for accessibility purposes. But we now, from experience, know that that benefits everyone. You know, people who have baby strollers, people who are just carrying their luggages, and they're on the go or travel, or people who are delivering goods to different places. And I really do think that even though this conversation has been about neurodivergent people, there's a huge spectrum in how we all focus, whether we feel like we're neurotypical or neurodivergent. In fact, it's probably more of a spectrum than the way we've been talking about it. We're using these binary terms just for an ease of conversation, just for the ease of conversation. But there really is more of a spectrum, research is showing. And I believe that by designing these tools to be more flexible, to be less rigid, to support diverse ways of working, it'll help us all.
Kevin, Marvel, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me on this.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Kevin Chow and Marvel Hariati speaking with me about a UBC study looking at how neurodivergent people use distraction blockers. That's all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.